call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order today. We have a wonderful presentation of by our honorable, formerly honorable, still honorable, perpetually honorable, Lane Shetterly, who headed up the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. And Lane is going to give us an overview of what the task force recommendations were and where they got to where they were going. We have two members of this committee, myself and Senator Morse, who were members of the restructuring task force. So committee members might want to ask us questions as well as Mr. Shetterly.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, it's great to be here. I can't tell you how good it feels to be down here and let you have that gavel. It gets heavy, doesn't it?
Gets heavy.
For the record, Lane Shetterly, an attorney in private practice in Dallas, and for the past interim, it was my honor and truly a pleasure to chair the Task Force on Revenue Restructuring. What I'm going to do today is take you through a quick overview of the task force, how we got to where we got, findings that we made as to the state and local revenue systems, and then recommendations that we are bringing forward, particularly the short-term recommendations, but then also touching on long-term options that we've also brought forward in the report. These slides are just a highlight of some of the major elements of what you will find in the printed report that goes into much more detail than what I'm going to be presenting today, but it will give you at least the context and a sense of the work of the task force and hopefully a good foundation to build on for legislative action this session, particularly on the short-term options. So beginning with that, and I would invite you to just pepper me with questions as we go. I'm happy to do that if you have questions as we get to a slide. And thank you for the offer to provide cover, Madam Chair, for questions that I might want to defer to you. The task force was created by House Bill 2530 last session. Senator Morse knows that very well, a sponsor of it. And it created this task force to review Oregon's revenue system, both state and local. A very important element of this task force was to be cognizant of the relationship between state and local revenue systems and the interdependency between those. And so we were very very intentional about that, and I think it has enhanced the utility of our recommendations and findings. The task force was composed of 30 members, a big group. The governor in the bill was actually designated the chair. I was humbled to have the governor ask if I would be interested in sitting in his place to chair the committee. I was humbled and also unwilling at the outset. Having been 7 years on the House Revenue Committee and been down the revenue restructuring path a few times, it doesn't usually lead to a particularly satisfying ending, as most of you know. And so it was not an easy thing to say yes to, but I was really persuaded by a couple of things, principally the governor's commitment to be personally invested in this, and he has been. I have had occasion to brief him during the course of the task force, so he's been very aware and in touch with what the task force is doing, supportive of our recommendations, I might add. And also he designated Tim Nesbitt, his deputy chief of staff, to participate with the task force. And again, as Madam Chair and Senator Morse know, Tim was as faithful, if not more so, than every member of the task force in his attendance and participation. So we had a good participation by the governor's office. The concern about a task force is that the legislature creates it one session and you go off into the weeds and get lost and they don't even send out a search party to come find you. but that's not what has happened here, and I think that the quality of the report you have before you speaks to the success of the process. In addition to myself, there were four senators. Senator Monroe and Senator Schrader were both appointed to this task force, and then we had four state representatives as well. That was provided in the bill. The rest of the appointees were from the governor, but directed in the bill to represent a broad cross-section of Oregon, and that is both geographical as well as by interest groups, political and philosophical persuasions. It was a very diverse task force, as those of you who sat on it and heard our conversations would attest. which leads me to just add this parenthetical before we get into the findings and recommendations. I'm pleased to say that these findings, that notwithstanding the diversity of membership on this task force, what I am presenting to you today in the way of our report and recommendations represents a consensus of that 30-member task force, which I think is an amazing outcome, but true. In addition to the members of the task force, we were assisted by a 7-member board advisory board, also provided for in the bill, including CPAs, tax attorney, accountants, economists, those kinds of interests to provide some technical and policy assistance. This slide is outdated in that we've already completed the initial report. We shopped that around the state in meetings in Medford, Newport, Eugene, Pendleton, and Redmond to get public input, and we had, of course, the meeting scheduled in Tigard on one of the snow nights that we had to cancel, but I think we did a good job of reaching out to the state and inviting participation and comment on this. We finished the report on the 8th of this month, and it's my pleasure to be here to present it to you today. We'll talk about the report in two parts to begin with, one state and one, and then we'll go to local. Even though we recognize the integration between these, it's helpful to look at these separately for the purpose of our findings, and as we get into our recommendations. The key finding on the state revenue system, and this is not going to be news to you who have served on this committee, but it bears repeating because it's still true and an important place to begin, and that is that the state revenue system is dependent on a highly volatile source, that being the personal income tax. We'll see evidence of that in this report and these slides that just makes that even more true and obvious today than it has been. On the other hand, in the local system, it's characterized by something completely different, and that is gross stability, but at a rate of growth that is not keeping pace with the cost of doing business at the local level. So where you have a volatile state revenue system that's all over the map in terms of growth and then declines, that is not the case, at least in terms of the fundamental funding source in the property tax at local revenue systems, very stable, but also not keeping pace with the growth of inflation. This illustrates the two systems sort of in the macro sense, the history of personal income tax and property tax revenue in the state. If you look at the income tax, you see several ups and downs, although they don't look big based on the scale. Back in the 80s, for instance, you see what looks like a very slight downturn. Of course, in the context of the times, that was a major downturn. And you see them following periodically, the worst and the most pronounced being the last one that we saw in 2001-2003. But this illustrates the volatility of the personal income tax, and each one of these declines that you see in the red line is attributable to economic downturns. And, of course, the growth that you see also in the red line is attributable to how the system responds to periods of economic growth. The black line is our property tax line. Relative stability, in fact, a high rate of stability. The only downturns that you see in the property tax line are really man-made. And those are both attributable to ballot measures, the first being in beginning in the early 90s, the implementation of Ballot Measure 5, which, as it was implemented over, I think it was 4 years or 5 years, reducing the property tax rates to a maximum of $15 per thousand, actually had the effect of reducing property tax revenue. But it's interesting to see what happened when Ballot Measure 5 became fully implemented. Ballot Measure 5 was still based on market value. That is, property was still being assessed at market value. And so once Ballot Measure 5 had become fully implemented and the property tax reductions had been achieved, up the taxes went again because the property taxes were still tied to market value. That resulted in a reaction that brought us Ballot Measure 47 and 50, to the effect of which was to divorce the property tax from market value to this artificial maximum assessed value. and then limit that growth at 3% a year. Of course, we're seeing something of more than 3% because of exception value that brings property online, in some cases more than 3%, bringing in more than 3% growth. But for the most part now, we're in a situation of a very static growth in the property tax revenue for local governments, a clear contrast between income and property taxes and how and the characteristics of both systems. Talking now about the state in particular, you know this, you've probably seen it already in your orientation, but this just illustrates Oregon's inordinate reliance on the personal income tax as a source of revenue for the state general fund. It's clearly out of line with U.S. averages, which are much more in the way of a balanced revenue system, but that's what we have. That's what we have to work with, and we'll see the impacts of that in the slides as we go forward. Oregon is the most dependent of any state on the personal income tax and the most dependent of any state on a single revenue tax source, and here's part of the problem with that. This is the slide that I like to call our cardiac arrest slide, and it represents the year-to-year volatility of the personal income tax. And this illustrates every characteristic of it. You see periods of fast and high growth, sustained growth in the 90s. The rates of growth weren't consistent, but if you see in the 1990s there, it was a sustained period of growth. With just as dramatic declines that occur on a year-by-year basis. The most dramatic on this chart, anyway, being the decline of 20% in the 2001 to 2003 recession, followed again by a very solid rebound as the economy recovered, personal income taxes recovered as well, but now finding ourselves probably in a situation very much like what we faced in the 2001-03 session. We really don't know yet where the bottom of that line is at the far end of the graph. It's interesting just to compare Oregon and Washington. I mentioned that Oregon is the most dependent of any state on a single income tax source or a single tax revenue source. Washington State, interestingly, is the second most dependent of all the states on a single source, but that source is the sales tax. And this slide just illustrates, for information purposes, the difference in volatility between Oregon and Washington revenue systems. you might think that with this. Well, and what it shows is that historically, the while the sales tax has been volatile, it's been less volatile and is more stable as a revenue source than Oregon's income tax. You might think that with this and the slide a couple before where we showed Oregon's inordinate dependence on income tax, that we were setting you up for a sales tax recommendation. I want to allay that concern. Now, we are not the task force, and Senator Morse can describe for you his journey through this, but the task force looked seriously at sales tax options, but in view of the history of the sales tax in Oregon as a proposal for tax reform and very current polling that, that Senator Morse was kind enough to share with us, it is clear that that's a non-starter. And I'm really pleased that the task force was very pragmatic in its recommendations to you not to come back after 14 months and say that we found the answer. We know the secret to our revenue system, and it's a sales tax. We have other recommendations for you. Again, just touching on the volatility of our revenue system, this illustrates it in another way. This is a picture of the 2001 recession. As you can see, all states across the country averaged a decline in revenue of 5.6%. So every state, on average, had that extent of decline. You can take Alaska out of the picture. It doesn't compare with any of the other states. Their revenue system is just different enough. And so really you're comparing the other 49 states, and among those 49 states, Oregon was in the very worst situation of all those states at a decline of 20.3% during that period of recession. And after that, the numbers started to bunch much more closely. California was next at 17, Massachusetts in at 14. But this illustrating the extent to which Oregon's dependence on personal income tax has left it vulnerable to changes in the economy. task force recognized in looking at our revenue system that the our budget, our revenue system is not only subject to, susceptible to changes in the economic cycles we've been looking at, but also the voter initiative system has had a profound impact on state spending. This slide illustrates that since 1990, 50% of new spending at the state level has been determined by voter initiatives. Principally, ballot measure 5, and we'll show how ballot measure 5 works in having that effect in the next slide, but also measure 50, measure 11, the first victims' rights measure, which had the had the impact of expense in, of course, in prison construction, but then on terms of budget, the ongoing cost of maintaining those prison populations and the staffing required to manage them. Measure 66, that was the State Parks Initiative, and Measure 99, health healthcare workers. Not all of those by any means are equal in terms of their impact, but the aggregate picture is that initiative process has had a profound effect on our state budget and spending. To illustrate this with Measure 5, this slide does that in spades. Before ballot measure 5 was fully implemented during the early 1990s, local property taxes accounted for 70% roughly of state K-12 school support, with the general fund filling in that other 30%. Measure 5, when it declared that property taxes would be reduced to $5 per thousand for schools, recognizing that would have a significant impact on school funding, dealt with that by including a provision that says basically, oh, and the state will make up the difference. That was how Measure 5 kept schools whole as property taxes were reduced. And the timing of this could probably could not have been better for our public schools. As Measure 5 came into effect in the 1990s, during that period really of almost unprecedented growth in the economy, the state was largely able to do that, to replace that foregone property tax revenue. Not cost-free. You talk to advocates of other areas of spending in the budget, particularly higher education, and during that period, other portions of the budget, the state budget, were significantly reduced as a share of state spending in order to accommodate the state's responsibility for the public school system, but we managed. But the effect, as you can see, has been profound, where now the state is supporting, is contributing 70% roughly of the state K-12 operating revenue, and that local share from property taxes has been reduced to 30%. There's been an exact switch between state and local responsibility as a result of a voter-approved initiative. This is a slide that I use in when I'm presenting this to the public, because it's good for the public to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about state revenue and the state general fund budget. There it is. 95% of it is education, human services, and public safety, illustrating that when you have a 10% or a 20% decline in revenues during any single biennium, those revenues are going to hit those high-priority program areas. As a member, when I was in the legislature, I know my favorite emails were the ones just telling me to cut unnecessary spending. And among education, human services, and public safety, I never quite knew which to choose. And this really illustrates that the budget is substantially prioritized to those three areas, with that 5% covering the difference, your budget, the governor's budget, other general fund programs, but a very minor part of it. So this just emphasizes, mostly for public information, the what's at stake when we're talking about the general fund budget. So, summary of our findings at the state level, and just a little bit about the process here. The task force did not begin with a conclusion that we were trying to build to. As I said, there were folks who came in hoping that, that we would evolve to a sales tax or something like that. But really, we did, a good job of dealing with facts, making findings, and then letting those facts set the table for what our recommendations were going to be. And so the first 6 months or so, we did very little other than get information, very much like what you get in your orientation about the state and local revenue systems, getting a picture of what's there. And these are our key findings, again, that are reflected in the report with much more detail behind them. Sort of the duh one to begin with, the state revenue system is volatile. We've seen that in spades in the slides preceding this. Volatile by reason of economic cycles and our dependence on a tax source that is that rides those cycles up and down. Also, though, a key finding that our general fund budget has also been substantially impacted by voter initiatives, again, clearly illustrated by the slides that I've shown you today. And an effect of this on a key area of school of state funding support responsibility, schools, is that by virtue of taking on the major share of school funding as part of the general fund budget, schools have been exposed to greater volatility in funding as part of the state general fund budget. That's why in the 2001-2003 recession, schools were not held harmless. Schools closed early. Because the state had to reduce funding for the state school fund. So schools are in this mix as well. And also, just kind of basic, but we deal with it in more detail in the report, but we do recognize that decisions that we make in any one legislative session have long-term implications. A program or a tax expenditure or new tax source that is initiated in one session, we have to keep in mind is going to play out for the indefinite future and be aware of what those long-term impacts are going to be on decisions that we make today. Finally, then, on the state level, we have a tip of the hat to the governor's other task forces that were working in this interim, transportation and health care. I should say we received reports occasionally from those task forces on what they were doing. We never got enough information, certainly not on the timeline that we and they were working for the task force to actually take a specific position on any recommendations that they've come forward, but recognizing, at least in general terms, that transportation and healthcare are also areas of immediate concern, apart from the structural issues that we've been looking at in the state revenue system. Okay, let's spend a little time on the local system. That sort of summarizes what we have on the state. Local system is all about property tax. Although, if you look in our report, there's an excellent couple of charts that show really what is the makeup of local revenues, and it's a wide array of revenues. But for general fund purposes, really, it's the property tax for most jurisdictions across the state. This just illustrates that impact of ballot measure 5, reducing property taxes from a state average. It looks like they're between $25 and $30 per thousand. As Measure 5 implemented, down to $15 per thousand, and that line can be drawn out to the edge of the graph just on and on and on. It's going to remain that way under ballot Measure 5. The next slide illustrates a point that I made earlier, but this is a good picture of it, how ballot Measure 50 divorced the property tax system from market value. The line that begins at the left of the slide and continues in red shows real market value, and that essentially is where we would be today in property taxes if Measure 5 were still the law of the land. But what you can see is that in 1997, in that legislative session, we separated our assessed value from market value to this thing called maximum assessed value as part of Measure 47, and then Measure 50, its reiteration. And part of ballot Measure 50 provides that once established, that assessed value, maximum assessed value, cannot grow more than 3% a year outside of certain exception events such as rezoning or new construction. That is why the property tax now shows such a stable rate of growth over time. this is just a longer-term picture of that disparity between market value and assessed value, mostly illustrating the very real economic effect that ballot Measure 50 has had in limiting the tax to the assessed value and that artificial 3% limitation. As a result of that, as property values grow, and that is market value grows, and at one rate, and maximum assessed value grows at a lesser rate. What this slide just shows is a growing disparity between reduction, I should say, of the effective tax rate. Between the difference between what property owners would pay if they were paying at the market rate and the rate that they are paying at the Measure 50 limited rate. Here is the slide that really we need to that really captures the predicament that local governments are in, and I think this is a good counter to the cardiac arrest slide that captured the state system. This shows, in a nutshell, where our issues are at the local level. The red line being city and county local government revenue derived from the property tax, the blue line being their expenditures. And let me say, that red line, Paul, it's all revenues, isn't it? It's not just property tax, it's all revenues.
Yes, that's correct. There's a table in the appendix that lists them all, goes on transient lodging and fees and permits and everything from the audit report.
So that's all revenue, again, the most basic source of it and most important to local governments being property taxes. But what you see here is a little bit of a problem in that currently revenues are already under expenditures, and that gap will grow over time. We'll take a closer look at that under the microscope in a minute and show you the extent of that. But this is a structural deficit that local governments are laboring under right now. In testimony and working with local government representatives, we think that they're accommodating that current gap by reducing services, closing libraries, laying off public safety, doing things that they have control over to reduce their costs of doing business at the local level. Others are accommodating it by spending out of reserves. Many local governments have had reserves, and that will get them through, but I think that combination of cuts and reserves is only going to keep local governments whole for so long, and we really do anticipate some very serious revenue and budget situations in the local government level here in the not-too-distant future based on what we see here. And I should also say that growth in expenditures assumes current services and no additional services. This is that microscope shot of the gap between revenue and expenditures. The red line represents a national forecast model that presumes a rate of inflation at one rate. The blue line presumes that the rate of inflation for the term shown in this slide, the current rate of inflation in 2006-07 carries on. You can see that under that assumption, you're at almost a $3 billion gap between local revenue and expenditures by 2018-2019. So it's somewhere from either serious to catastrophic out there in terms of the long-term projection for local governments based on the property taxes as their fundamental source of revenue. We are perhaps seeing in the short term a lessening of inflation. There's even talk of deflation that could affect this line in the short term. I think the expectation is that whatever our short-term situation may be in that respect, we're more likely to see long-term inflation than not. And so while these numbers may not be perfect, I think the trend that they illustrate is still true. So our summary findings of the local government revenue. Local revenue is still closely tied to property tax, but that is limited by Measure 50. And rising inflation puts local fiscal system under significant stress as the rate of inflation exceeds the rate of growth in revenues that are limited by ballot Measure 50. A key element here, permanent property tax rates were locked into the Constitution in 97 by virtue of ballot Measure 50 and do not reflect changes since then. And I'll just illustrate one that brings that home. In 1997, Josephine County had one of the lowest rates in the state. They're down around, 60 cents, I think, per thousand, something like that. Why? Because Josephine County was a substantial beneficiary of forest revenues. So when the federal forest monies go away, as we anticipate that they will, that permanent tax rate will not change for Josephine County, even though circumstances will have changed dramatically between 1997 and where they are today and where they will be when those federal forest funds are finished. Measure 50 has locked that permanent rate in the Constitution, and it cannot be changed without a statewide constitutional amendment to do that. In Deschutes County, Senator Helfer, you may know, I think it was the sheriff's levy that had the unhappy experience of going away the day that the permanent rates were fixed under ballot measure 50, so that the Deschutes County sheriff doesn't have a permanent rate. It was zero, and it will be zero for all time until the Constitution is amended. And I say that because I know that we tried to amend the Constitution in about 2001, I think, to fix that problem for the Deschutes County Sheriff's Levy, and I think another district in Linn County that had the same problem. And when you put amends Constitution property tax on a statewide vote, even though it was not going to affect any taxpayers except in those districts, that constitutional amendment went down in flames. But that is a reality, that permanent rates were locked in 1997, and whatever has happened since then makes no difference in terms of those permanent rates, and they're non-responsive to that change. Measure 50 also has created inequities, horizontal inequities, by virtue of this separation of market value from assessed value. That is, you do have property owners with properties of equal market value paying significantly different rates of tax because of the vagaries of that maximum assessed value under ballot measure 50. So you have that horizontal inequity. Another thing that we think is important to point out is the integration, the linkage between state and local services. What comes to mind on that, to illustrate that, is last year in Curry County, as Curry County was facing the imminent loss of federal forest funds. You heard noise out of Curry County that they were ready to turn over the keys to the courthouse to the state and let the state operate. And it's a point that the state and counties serve common constituents, and if services cannot be provided by local governments, then the state is going to find itself in a position of having responsibility for that. And this task force, I think, has brought that out in bold relief, that integration of these two systems. All right, with all of that, based on those findings, what are our recommendations? And I should say that we have divided our recommendations into short-term. And short-term means 2009. These are recommendations that we are proposing that the legislature enact, or at least put out the door, in this legislative session. When I'm done with this, we'll talk about some long-term options, which have of a different character. But really, these are recommended for not just for discussion, but for action. The first is the methodology related to revenue forecasting and rainy day fund. This is derived on the findings of the task force relative to the volatility of the income tax, how it rises and falls with economic cycles. The risk to that, of course, in an income tax-dependent system is that if you don't have a reserve or a rainy day fund to draw on when your revenues fall, you're left with three things, either cuts or borrowing or raising taxes and fees in order to hold things together until the economy recovers, all three of which have drawbacks and all three of which are very difficult to do. We can go a long ways toward improving and substantially improving our revenue system by creating a viable rainy day fund to be available when the economy takes its dives, as we know that it periodically does. We got a start on that in 2002. Really, it was the first venture that we made into rainy day funds. And if you think about it, that was back in the last recession. It was the middle of the last recession. It was during the special sessions, in fact, during that famous year of the non-ending legislative session, where we referred to the voters the Education Stability Fund, which voters approved, has a funding source tied to lottery. And so far, and we see the picture of lottery is changing, but so far has done a very good job of providing a rainy day fund for education. That's kindergarten through university. It's dedicated to those purposes. It is only available based on economic triggers, decline. It's 2 quarters of declining employment, revenue forecast 2% below the end of session forecast. And I think in the case of the Education Stability Fund, if the governor declares an emergency and you have a supermajority vote of the legislature, but still, the point being, it really is a rainy day fund intended to be drawn on during the very harsh economic times and not just as an extra fund to go to when somebody wants to increase the budget. And that's done. Stay on this one for that's done a good job, but it's not enough. It's not enough. And in fact, the legislature recognized that in 2007 when it created the rainy day fund, statutory rainy day fund to undergird the other 55% of the budget that isn't supported by the Education Stability Fund. And I think our numbers in that are, what, about $360 million or so in that rainy day fund. That was funded by a one-time appropriation of the corporate kicker and then a promise to deposit 1% of the ending fund balances going forward. A good start, but also inadequate both in terms of amount, as we're seeing today, and also in terms of ongoing funding. Two things you need in a rainy day fund is size. It needs to be big enough to be useful when the budget falls into decline. And secondly, it needs to have a funding source that is robust enough to fill it again in time to be drawn on when the next cycle comes. Our policy advisors to the task force looked at this. They looked at other states and determined that a range of 12 to 15% of general fund budget was a recommended range to establish as a rainy day fund or reserve. We have 5% in the Education Stability Fund. And the statutory rainy day fund is 7%. Now, currently?
7.5.
7.5. We're recommending that that be increased, first of all, to 10%, so that between the two you have a 15% rainy day fund. And that addresses the size. But then what about the funding? And for that we have looked at the revenue forecast and what is now the income tax kicker as a source of funding, a way to take advantage of unanticipated revenue in excess of budget during good times, put that away in a rainy day fund, the statutory rainy day fund that we would also elevate to constitutional status so that voters have the trust and confidence that it will truly be a rainy day fund and, again, not just a savings account to be drawn into. So what we are proposing is a change in the forecast methodology relative to the kicker, whereby the state economist would still make a forecast, as the state economist does today, in May of each year, each biennium, each legislative session, predicting what the forecast, the revenue will be for the coming biennium, legislature then adopting a budget that is tied to that forecast. What we know about that forecast, though, and the only thing we really know with any reliability over history, is that that forecast is always wrong. And that's not a criticism of the state economist, Tom Petowsky, or his predecessor, Paul Warner. That is simply a recognition of the size of our economy and the extent to which it is susceptible to national and even international impacts. And so it's wrong. We know it's wrong. And what we can do is, over time, measure how wrong have we been, which gets us to a margin of error. Please, somebody come up with a better term than standard deviation. But that's what we have. We can look back over history of the kicker, and we can calculate how wrong have we been over time. And what we're proposing then is that every biennium you apply that standard deviation to the forecast, and to the extent that revenues come in above that budget number, above that specific number that you get from the economist, and within the margin of error, within that standard deviation, that money is appropriated to this newly elevated constitutional rainy day fund and can only be accessed then when those triggers are met. And then to the extent that revenues in any biennium exceed that standard deviation, they kick to voters just the way the kicker does today. And once that rainy day fund has been filled and reached that 10% threshold, then we revert to current law, so that at that point, then any excess that comes in a following biennium, to the extent it exceeds 2%, would kick just the way the kicker applies today. So we're substantially leaving in place the kicker, but we are using it as a means of funding this new this newly established constitutional rainy day fund. To illustrate how this would work, in 2007, we had a kicker. And just on the precipice of the decline that you are now struggling with, the state reverted $1.2 billion to taxpayers. Same thing happened before the 2001-03 recession. I don't remember the size of the kicker at that point. It was very large. How much was it, Paul? Do you remember offhand?
In 2001?
Yeah.
It was about $250 million.
Okay, $250 million went back to voters just as we were falling into that 20% decline in revenue. In this case, if our recommendation had been in place in 2007, standard deviation right now is 5.6%. That means that we would have captured about $800 million of that excess revenue during that biennium to put into this rainy day fund, and there still would have been a $400 million kicker to revert to taxpayers. That's how viable and robust this funding methodology for this rainy day fund is. And so then, between these two, between the lottery-funded Education Stability Fund, this rainy day fund, you have both a viable size of reserve funds at 15%, and you have a viable funding mechanism for both that makes them useful to not this legislature, unfortunately, but to certainly to future legislatures, because we know this cycle will come again. Just before I leave this, I have to say that this was not the creation of the task force. It was not my brainchild or anybody else's on the task force. This goes back to work that the legislature has seen in the past. And in fact, I told the Portland City Club last week that the first recorded example of the use of this methodology in history was in Egypt about 3,000 years ago, probably, when Joseph suggested to Pharaoh that during the years of plenty, why don't we just put some of that extra grain in the silos and save that for the lean years to come? Joseph was hailed as a wise man for that, divinely inspired. I like to say he had a dream. But it's true. Saving in those good times for those downturns that we know are coming is smart. And this is a way to use current resources to do that. Next, balanced budget rule to ballot initiatives. There are really two things in this. There was one element to this until our last meeting, and then Senator Morse led the charge, and we have another element to this bullet point. The first being that considering the impact that ballot initiatives have had on the state budget and general fund, we think it's important to elevate to voters the information that they need when an initiative is going to have a significant fiscal or revenue impact. That is, it's going to cost money or it's going to reduce revenue to the state. We know that in the voters' pamphlet there is the discussion of the price tag committee for each initiative that does lay out in very specific terms costs, but that information appears below the ballot title, below the yes and no question, the summary, the explanatory statement, and maybe just is not as prominently placed as it could be. Our proposal here is to amend the ballot title law, and this could be done statutorily. As a side note, the first bullet does require constitutional amendment. This could be done statutorily to add language to the ballot title that simply says this measure has a significant fiscal impact or this measure has a significant revenue impact. We're not recommending specific wording, but something that calls to the voter's mind that this measure costs money. We think that's good information. It's information that you depend on before you vote on bills in this legislature, and it's information that that voters should have front and center. And the way to do that is to place that actually in the ballot title. So as they see that on the ballot, it calls to their mind that there's a cost to this. And it doesn't say vote yes or no. It just means be aware that there is a cost, and it calls them to perhaps to examine that price tag information in the ballot title. We think that's better information that improves the ballot process. The other thing that Senator Morse introduced that you'll find in the report is a way to enhance legislative participation in the initiative process. We have a couple of just four instances in the report, one being to hold legislative hearings on initiatives that have qualified for the ballot, so there's an opportunity for full and open public discussion on the record, outside of a campaign scenario, but in a hearing, to augment information about the particular initiative. The other, Senator Morse has proposed, would take a constitutional amendment to transform Oregon's initiative system into an indirect initiative whereby measures that qualify for the ballot would first be routed through the legislature for possible adoption or amendment, and then re-referral to the ballot in the appropriate cases. So in both of these, we think that there are ways to address the initiative and its impact on state budget. Then in law, short-term recommendations, recommendation to develop a systematic long-term budgeting process that includes capital spending. And that is really to look at fiscal and revenue impacts of measures, probably we're thinking on a 10-year basis, look out that far to get a good gauge of what the long-term impacts are going to be of decisions that you make in each session. Not just the next biennium or even the next two biennia, but really taking that long-term picture to see how the roll-up costs of particular measures are going to have an effect on state budgeting, and also to include in that a recognition of capital spending requirements. So that simply is not factored into spending projections now, even though we know that buildings need to be replaced. You'll not find that in the long-term spending plan and recommendation really coming from George Naughton, our budget director, that it would be a good idea to include that kind of information in a capital spending plan so that it is there in legislators' minds. Then also our recommendation at the local level, you'll see that the first three really address the state level. What about the local level? Recognizing that voters just aren't there yet on a constitutional amendment, for instance, to change ballot measure 50. We toyed with that, but I think it was a consensus of the committee, again, based on in part on Senator Morse's polling. Voters aren't there, and our interest was not in recommending something that would almost be certain to fail. And so rather than to go in that direction in the short term, we are recommending to the legislature at least to take the Hippocratic Oath, and that is first do no harm going forward, and that is not taking further actions to reduce to impose restrictions on local government's ability to raise revenue. Not imposing new mandates on local governments without providing the funding for them, and to review even existing restrictions on local government revenue raising, current preemptions that exist in law. No specific recommendations on that, but that the legislature take those to heart in this coming session. And then finally, on the short-term recommendations, begin the work of establishing an ongoing process. We think that whether you're talking about more fundamental changes in the local property tax system or in certainly in the state system, if ever there's going to be something like a sales tax, and we're not recommending that again, but there is value in an ongoing process of engaging the public on these revenue issues. It's complicated. Voters have a vague sense of how the system works, but as you know on this committee, it's not intuitive. And we really think that voters deserve to be better informed, and that's going to take an intentional and persistent effort to engage and inform them and to develop a best way to pay for services that voters want. Something perhaps in the model of the chalkboard project. Again, we're not recommending a particular methodology, but we think that there is value just in that. On the long-term options that we're presenting, first, to the extent that this engagement with the public would produce information that would suggest possible reforms of a different nature than we're recommending short-term, then use that in the long-term. The message here really is if we're going to engage the public in a discussion about revenue restructuring and just the structure of our revenue systems on a long-term basis, we can't begin with a predetermined outcome and expect that to be a process that just brings them on board. It really does have to be open and to let the process be guided by information, and then use that information as it is derived to develop more fundamental restructuring, as that may be informed by those that engagement process. Looking at the local revenue system, as I said, we're not making any recommendations in this session, certainly to reform ballot measure 50, but I think it's clear that there are issues at the local level that cannot wait much more beyond this biennium. They're going to have to be addressed. And if it's not going to be in property tax reform, then the legislature needs to work with local governments in looking at ways to diversify local revenues. That could be, and I'm speaking for myself here, it's more a prediction than a recommendation, and this is not coming from the task force, but, you know, one potential source, for instance, a real estate transfer tax, some other source that currently is preempted from local governments that might provide additional revenue away from having to go back to voters for a constitutional amendment to change the property tax system. And also in this, being very aware that the timeline is short, and expressly so and emphatically so because of the imminent loss of federal timber revenue over the next 4 years, that is going to make the local revenue system even more dire. Then we do recommend that the legislature and this public process continue to analyze other restructuring proposals. This is where we put the sales tax stuff. You've got five scenarios that show you five different ways to skin a cat. And there are 50 ways. There are 150 ways. But this shows you some illustrative systems that would be completely different than what we have now. Eliminating the income tax and replacing it with a sales tax, going to a gross receipts tax. And it's really there more for information and to inform future discussion. I'll say again, we are not making a recommendation on sales tax in this report. I think that brings me to the end of my remarks. I do want to thank the chair and Senator Morse for their devoted participation. I think both of you were in Pendleton, for instance. That's a ways to go. Oh, you were in Redmond. You made it to Redmond. You were in Pendleton.
We covered it in Eastern Oregon between us.
But also, I want to commend the task force. The commitment of this task force among all 30 members was just stunning. We had excellent attendance and participation. We met on a monthly basis. I was afraid we might wear people out. We did not. And the participation was equally strong. Folks were not afraid to speak up, and we had some very robust discussions from time to time. But again, I will emphasize as I close that what I'm bringing you today in terms of our findings, short-term recommendations, and long-term recommendations really does represent a consensus of that broad 30-member task force, and I'm very proud of that and of the members who got to that point. So I commend it to you. I understand that there are bills in draft to implement even now, our short-term recommendations. I am pleased to say that we have the governor's support of those recommendations as well. I commend them to you. This is the handoff. And anything that I can do as the session goes to support you in carrying this forward, I will be happy to do that. So thank you for the opportunity, first, to participate in this task force, and second, to be among your august company today. I'll be glad to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Lane. And I want the committee to know that when Mr. Shetterly was first asked to do this by the governor, I believe his actual comment was, "I've seen this movie. I know how it ends." Am I quoting you correctly?
I think that's about that.
And the fact that he was able to change the ending and actually come out with something that, I mean, we have the data to show that if we can get a couple of these things through, we will address a lot of the problem of the volatility, certainly, of our tax system. And so it was we wouldn't have done it without strong leadership from our chair. And Lane has years and years of experience in our seats on the other side of the chamber of the body, and it showed, and your leadership showed, and we just simply would not be here, and I just want that on the record without his leadership.
I humbly receive that, and thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We also had Ben Featherston in here for a while. It looks like he's gone, but
he was a
member of the task force, and it really was quite a diverse group, and I think it's a pretty significant accomplishment that we were able to get consensus on some very meaningful recommendations. So do committee members, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Chair, just a comment before I asked a question in that I've had the, I guess, honor, I would say, for the last 6 years to have another Shetterly sit in front of me in the same position in the city of Bend. Lane's brother Brian is the head of our long-term or long-range planning department, and spent many hours with him. And occasionally, I had to look back at Lane to make sure I wasn't listening. And some same inflections in body language, et cetera. So it's fun to continue the relationship with the Shetterly family. My question is, and I have not read through the whole report, and I know there was a poll taken for response, but what was the general sense, the feedback that you got when you took the dog and pony show on the road? What was the flavor of the response?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, very good. I would say that we didn't pack them in. but of those who selected themselves to come and talk to us about it, I would say that the most consistent criticism we got were from that 28% or so of Oregonians who are diehard sales tax supporters and disappointed that we didn't come out with a sales tax. For the most part, very supportive, and I think that also goes for written comments we received. There is in the report a summary of the testimony that we got in those roadshows, but really very supportive. And I think again, the most stinging criticism were from folks who thought that we ducked the sales tax and weren't bringing that out first.
Thank you.
Lane, we had some discussion in the tax restructuring task force about the process that the state of Virginia used to get meaningful tax reform. Could you say a little bit about that to the committee? Because that may actually be something we look at in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That was one of the processes that we looked at for this engagement that is the one of the short-term recommendations. And I'll ask for your help to remind me, but as I remember, this was brought to us by Jerry Carruthers. Jerry Carruthers, who was a member of the task force and had been in Virginia when Virginia did an exercise, a reform of their tax system. And the interesting thing about that was that that process, while it had legislative and executive participation, was really driven by the local, by the private sector. Businesses and private sector were at the lead. They created a nonprofit corporation, as I recall, that coordinated this effort. And there was very much involvement by public officials in this. And certainly when it was done, they took it to the legislature for enactment. He thought that it benefited from that aspect of really not coming from government, but coming from the private sector, coming from taxpayers. It was a stunning success, apparently, in Virginia. I did mention in my remarks, closer to home, a model we have that's not too dissimilar to that, the use of private foundations that have come together to form the Chalkboard Project and to operate that. Again, outside of government, but still with close connections because it's dealing with matters of significant public policy. Those are both, I think, models that the legislature could help kickstart, but I think both of them are dependent upon private sector leadership and participation.
And the other thing that kind of came out as we were having this discussion, and this what keyed me off was the criticism that we didn't go to a sales tax, but you call the diehards. And Senator Morris actually last session had quite a bit of experience with a bill that you and a bipartisan group of legislators put together. And I was always interested in your comments about what happened when you took this to a focus group. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to elaborate on that a little bit, because it's kind of related to some of the conversations we had here.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In the focus groups, I just maybe give the background. I was asked to come into the focus group as a research assistant, and that was my title. We had two groups. They were back-to-back, and they were, must have been maybe 15, 16 people in each group. And I gave the background. So you had, and this was all the fine work of Paul Warner and his staff putting this data together for us, you had the background so people had an understanding of where we have been and where we are today vis-a-vis the volatility issues, same kind of data that we have illustrated here, and the initiative impact, and then looking at alternatives. And the alternative that we specifically presented was a balanced system where you did have a reduction, significant reduction, in capital gains, personal income tax, and you had a balanced system between regressivity and progressivity with the earned income tax credit, low income rent relief. It was very comprehensive, very balanced, and I think an excellent, excellent tax reform proposal.
You're leaving one thing out, Senator Morris, that it had in it.
Well, it had
a consumption tax.
And at the end of the day, when we polled the interest groups, as I recall, there were only two people that said no, they would not support that. So the question is, how do you get that breadth and depth of understanding with Oregon voters? I have personally, in my journey here in the legislature, public service, have had that dying conviction, although the flame is diminishing, that undying conviction that people would in fact vote their own self-interest, and that if you had a tax reform plan that lessened the tax burden by broadening the base, balanced the progressive regressive nature of it, and backfilled it with a consumption tax, that in fact people would say, aha, I like that. Well, the polling that we did to find out where Oregon is today, given this task force work, the conclusion we've come to is that we, the legislators, we just are not trusted. Mm. That chasm is so wide that if we propose something, that it's an add-on and it's an increase. And people are just not willing to go there. And I don't know how you bridge that with a greater depth of essentially faith in what we do. We are not highly trusted. And so I think the proposals that were coming forth short term are excellent, and I would like to at least make sure that our awareness is complete, that in the polling that we did on changing the kicker, now this is a sacred issue, you know, in Oregon, in reforming the way we forecast and building a rainy day fund, putting it in the Constitution, that polled 68%. So and it's very similar to the polling that we did in 2003, again, trying to run a tax or a kicker reform measure in the building, very consistent. And then the initiative process and having a more thoughtful process, we had a 2-to-1, about a 61% favorable in that. So it gives us, if we're going to refer something out constitutionally, it gives us a good basis to say, it stands a reasonable chance of being adopted.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I agree, and I just go back to what I said about this task force having a real pragmatic spirit about it, and I think that says it, that there were those of us who probably would like to shoot for the moon, but I think, and I think the rest of the task force got there, that it would be a shame to reach for the moon and miss some real improvements short of that, that in fact are doable, and that while not easy, can be accomplished. And so that, I think, really is the nature of the recommendation that are before you. It's not a shoe-in, but I think that done carefully, done thoughtfully, it has high likelihood of success in the among the voters.
When it comes to the volatility of our tax system, I think, you know, just in my, you know, travels around my district and other places in Oregon, because of the economic volatility we've had since 2002, I think it's been quite an education process for the voters. And even the voters who just love their kicker, some of them that I talk to consider it kind of a guilty pleasure. They do get it, that this is not the best fiscal policy we could do, and I think that's how we got to 68%.
Well,
who doesn't love a check around Christmas time?
Just to support that, Madam Chair, if I may, going back to Senator Telfer's question about how this fared on the roadshow, Paul, I think you told me about a meeting that you and Senator Morse had down in, was it Brownsville?
Albany.
Albany, hardly a bastion of higher taxes, more government. And as I recall, your report on this said that it was received very well, until they thought you started talking about a sales tax, and then they turned on you.
No, Senator Morse actually described the proposal, and
yes,
that was received very well. I just gave him the bad news on the revenue situation, and when I was done, one of the people got up and said that he smelled a hint of a sales tax. So that's just indicative of you know, some of the public concerns.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Lane, I do want to applaud all the work that went into this. I saw a little of it from a distance, and clearly I think it was different from other processes that I've seen before. But I think the questions or comments that people are making does highlight one of the things that I'm thinking about, which is there's a certain amount of assumption in these recommendations that there's rational behavior on the part of voters and or legislators, that if you just put information in front of people, whether it's the facts about initiatives and how much they'll cost, or whether you put in front of legislators 10-year projections about things that we're voting on, that will do different things than we have done in the past. And would that were true, but I guess I'm a little more skeptical about having long conversations, long enough for people to even hear sort of the truth about stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've just seen it fail so many times that maybe I'm sort of I'm the triumph of hopelessness over something. But
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, take hope. I do understand that. I mean, and I think you have to address this with a healthy dose of real politic, and that there will be a vigorous public discussion about this. Having said that, I'm greatly encouraged by, for instance, the polling results longitudinally. I mean, a couple of years ago and still today, that indicate voters get it on the issue of the rainy day fund and reserves. Because there, I think voters do. They may not get all the details, but they get the idea of setting aside money during good times to have it available to draw on when times aren't good. I mean, voters understand that happens. And that seems to be a concept that not only do they get, but they support. And this really ties in with that. That's what this is. And so I think this is one that that can be successfully brought before voters and passed. So I'm more hopeful.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, I would assume that these recommendations are ones agreed to, but not necessarily everything that everybody thinks we should be doing, because clearly, if you look at the report, there are things that are pretty popular and look doable, mm-hmm. but aren't in these short-term or long-term recommendations. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, such as corporate minimum, yeah.
Or alcohol.
Sure,
or
sure.
Cigarette taxes.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that. That's important. We made a decision as a task force through the year that we would focus on really the key basic structural issues of the system. Discrete policy inputs, such as raising the corporate minimum, reducing the capital gains tax, raising the inheritance tax exemption, beer and wine. Those are discussions that will be had in the building, in the policy, the revenue committees, and we'll, you know, go through the usual political process. My real concern as chair was that to bring those issues in for debate and try to create that specific a package of recommendations, we would probably fail. Because I think the consensus would be very difficult to achieve, just as it is in the public and in the building. And so on the one hand, we punt it. And we say, you know, if you want to raise the corporate income tax to make the system raise more money, do it. But it's not part of our recommendations. However, I will say that stability is a virtue in itself. Because you can make the system as big or as small as you want by raising the income tax rate, by raising beer and wine tax, by raising the corporate minimum tax. But if you are still going through that period, those periods of boom and bust, you still haven't accomplished what really needs to be done here in stability. So we've created a system that really you can make as big or small as you want, and that future legislatures can make as big or small as they want. But the stability in itself is going to be important in maintaining whatever level of funding and services the legislature from time to time deems to be in the best interest of the state.
Yeah, and I headed up the early, we kind of broke into two groups, a long-term and a short-term, and the short-term group that I kind of headed up in the early days basically lumped the beer and wine and the corporate minimum. We had a little category that we called revenue raisers, and you could even put some of the preemption issues. If you lifted preemption on some, you could put those in that category. But Lane's right. I mean, we focused as a group on the things that would create structural change in the initiative and the rainy day fund were the two main ones of that. But that certainly doesn't preclude we recognize that we need more revenue in the system, and so, you know, to go back to some of those things that we at least discussed as part of the short-term methods, those options are still there, and nothing in this task force was meant to preclude discussion on, you know, specific revenue raisers.
The beauty of this, if I may, Madam Chair and Senator Rosenbaum, the beauty of this is that people who support smaller government or larger government can all get behind this, because it will stabilize whatever their vision of what the size of government should be.
Senator Hass.
Thank you. It's always been interesting to me that the amount of energy and heat and light we can put on raising the beer or wine tax or cutting capital gains is, you know, just, but when it comes to looking at the broader picture, that energy isn't there. And I think maybe it's because it's just easier to digest a beer tax than, you know, tax reform or restructuring. But I think we've said many times, if we could just get every voter in Oregon to spend a year on a revenue committee up here, and that really is, I think, the problem. It's not in these proposals necessarily. It is the engagement component to really get people to look at this in the same way they look at duct tape issues at the Rose Parade, or the same way they do look at a beer tax or some of these other issues. And that's really, you know, that's a very difficult thing. Tom McCall could not do it, and you know, he was a pretty inspiring guy. And you know, I appreciate the polling data and the pragmatism that goes along with it. But whenever somebody talks to me about a poll, I always point out, you know, the civil rights issues didn't poll very well in the 60s either. Nonetheless, those laws were passed, and you know, those laws are kind of the defining, some of the defining laws of our of this country. So I realized they didn't have to go to a statewide ballot to pass those. But I guess my issue now has kind of evolved through this. I've gone through a couple of Lane's task forces, and we've been on our road shows, and that it's not so much just a tax restructuring proposal, sales tax or not sales tax issue, as much as it is inspiring people to kind of rally around the cause and say, look, we should do something. We do have, as you pointed out, the most volatile tax system in the country. And there's a common good achievement here if we can rally around, pay attention, and try to fix it.
Senator Morris.
I believe one thing that we have not done, and I say that back in history as a legislative body, is to actually define what the goals are and then design tax reform around those goals and then adopt it. We've not taken that leadership position. And I know, be on public record, I, for one, would be willing to do that.
Well, we will actually have legislation before this committee on our tax policy issue, and that's a potential vehicle to do just that. We do have goals in our statutes and, you know, objectives, but it's always good to take a fresh look at them and...
Madam Chair, if I may, and Senator Morris, just further our conversation here. I think it is important, though, and I know that you appreciate it. It is important to recognize how really significant these short-term recommendations would be, not just in the short term, but in the long term. They really would be significant in improving the system that we have. And while we have those hoped-for longer-term discussions on more reform, I think it's important if we have a moment in time when the public is there, the legislature can bring forward the product, and the voters can approve it to stabilize our system, to make it the best that it can be today. That's very significant. That doesn't preclude those further discussions, but I think it's very important because we know that in 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, there will be a recovery from this recession. We will find ourselves in high revenue cycle, and then we will fall again. And this is the opportunity to set the net under that next fall to catch the state revenue system. And I can't overstate how important I think that really is as revenue reform.
Other questions, comments? Thank you so much
for
coming.
You.
And we really appreciate your report and your work on this issue.
My pleasure, and it goes both ways. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And we will probably drag you back testify on some of the specifics.
There's a special place in heaven for Lane Sheridan.
There is.
The revenue committee.
We are adjourned.
Or a combination.